Last week, we have been looking at chapter 1 concerning Nehemiah's prayer that he has offered unto God. And the prayer, he starts in verse 6 of chapter 1, says, "Let thine ear now be attentive and thy eyes open, that thou mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now, day and night, for the children of Israel, thy servants. And confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Both I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the judgments which thou commandest thy servant Moses. Remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, If ye transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if ye turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out unto the uttermost parts of the heaven, yet will I gather them from thence and will bring them into the place that I have chosen to set my name there. Now these are thy servants and the people whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. O Lord, I beseech thee, now let thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name, and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man." In this, when you look, we looked a little bit concerning Nehemiah's request last week, started on his prayer to God. Several things that we're not told, but we may have to, through necessary inference, come to the conclusion that we do know that in Daniel it is mentioned that during the reign of Cyrus, after 70 years, that Cyrus was going to be raised up to allow the people to come back. Now, in Nehemiah's prayer that he is giving, and we looked at before concerning the words of God to Moses, that when these people do depart and I scatter them abroad into captivity, that when they repent, he would bring them back and so forth from wherever they are, back to Jerusalem. Of course, Daniel says during Cyrus, during that time, that they would be coming back and so forth. The question you would have to look at is, number one, God said that he was going to do this through his providence, bring back a remnant. Number two, in the repentance, what all is involved in that? They may not have been able to, being in the foreign country that they were in, to keep the observance of all the law and the statutes. We know that they probably could not have kept the feast because what was destroyed? That they couldn't go back to and to the structure and to keep the feast, that they had to go back to the three feasts annually and so forth. Temple was destroyed. Jerusalem was destroyed. So as far as the feast, they were still not in compliance with that. So you have to look at the two sides where God is saying, I am going to bring a remnant back. If they do this and do that, then I will be attentive to them, bring them back. So under both circumstances, you see God's providence working. You also see that in Nehemiah's prayer, he is saying to an extent that there are those that fear the Lord, and that in fearing him, they are in essence saying, he's saying, we have transgressed your commandments, we have dealt corruptly with you. And he said, hear now, beseech the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name. So even though they were in captivity, there were those who still feared the name. You had a remnant that came back. There was initiated reforms going on then back with Zerubbabel and so forth. So you see the turn of the people again turning back to God with what they had missed for the last 70 years. Turning back, trying to get back into that, doing the Lord's will again in Jerusalem. Of course, it's not totally rebuilt yet, and that's what Nehemiah is going to be doing, is going to back to rebuild the walls and so forth. But he opens and closes his prayer with the earnest plea to hear. Let your ear be attentive, your eyes open, that you may hear my prayer. He says, remember the word that was commanded to Moses. So the words that Moses had, these were the words that came from God that Moses had, and he brings that forth and calls forth that scripture concerning the covenant of the promise that God made to Moses on God's faithfulness of his word. It's still there. if they return. And Nehemiah is bringing that forth, not that God needed to be reminded of it, but Nehemiah is saying, Lord, this is your covenant, that if we do this, then you would respond in this way. And he's saying, you know, this is what Moses, if you turn unto you and keep the commandments and do them, that even though we were cast out, you would gather them and bring them back. And so he's not trying to say, well, God, you forgot that, but he is just reassuring the covenant, and he was well aware of it, well aware of the scripture, that if we do this, you will bring us forth back. Concerning more or less God's faithfulness, not his remembrance, but his faithfulness. This is a promise that you made, the covenant that you made. Again, he asked to be prospered in this thing. When you look at Joseph in bondage, the Lord prospered him quite a bit in the various situations that he was in, that he was prospered in Genesis 39, 3 and 23. And again, Nehemiah states here that he was prospered in the rebuilding of the wall, and it was through God that allowed him to be prospered. He asked mercy to be granted to him in the sight of the king, because it would be the king's decision on what Nehemiah could do or couldn't do, since he was under his leadership in that respect. And Nehemiah also makes confession. We know Nehemiah prays to God quite regularly. He's familiar with the scriptures. I'm not sure what sins that he would have felt that he had committed personally. The same as when you look at Daniel. Daniel was righteous, even though he was in a foreign country, but there was probably things that he could not keep and do. Again, concerning the feast and so forth, he could not keep and do them. So Nehemiah says, my prayers before you day and night. He confesses and intercedes on behalf of Israel and all those that had sinned against him. He even says, we, includes himself, we have dealt corruptly against you in verse 7. We have not kept the commandments, the statutes, the ordinances, which were given to Moses, again in verse 7. So he realized that the consequences of the sin of Israel had put them in this difficult position, and it was due to their disobedience under their own rule and their own freedom. It wasn't because of this time now that, Lord, we can't keep them, but it was because when they were not in bondage, they did not keep the commandments and ordinances of God. They left him. And in leaving him, then God said, you will go into captivity. So Nehemiah includes himself in the transgression against God. When you look at verse 6, he said, which we have sinned against thee, both I and my father's house. In verse 7, he says, we have dealt corruptly with you. So there were ordinances which were to be kept by Israel, which had been abandoned while in captivity, and he also, Nehemiah, confessed on his part for not keeping them in verse 7. The prayer of Nehemiah is not offered up on behalf of all the Jews in captivity, but it's spoken by Nehemiah on behalf of thy servant, which was Nehemiah, and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name in verse 11. So there were others of the mindset that feared Jehovah's name. That doesn't mean that they were scared of it. The fear here is reverence, that there were those that reverenced his name in respect to the commands that he wanted done. So Nehemiah was not alone. There was others in captivity, and that is the remnant that is spoken about, that were in captivity, that also had the reverence for God and wanted to do his will. Did they suffer? Yes, the innocent suffered. They were also carried away into captivity, and we have records of those, Nehemiah being one, Daniel being one, others, that they had suffered. So in that regard, even though you're trying to keep the Lord's word and his commands, the innocent do suffer. So we can expect that. That's how he concludes chapter 1 in his prayer, after he hears of the situation of Jerusalem, how it stands, what it looks like, and the reproach that is there. And so, any questions on chapter 1? Chapter 2 is set in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, in the Jewish month of Nisan. Nisan was the name given by the Persian Jews to the month previously called Abib, which was the first month of the Jewish calendar. As you would know, there has been a passing of 4 months from the ninth month in chapter 1 to the first month in chapter 2. So there's 4 months that this is weighing on Nehemiah's mind. There's 4 months that he's thinking about this, that it has him so grief-stricken. His continued prayers before God concerning the situation of the fellow Jews in Jerusalem and the condition of the city. He relates that in his position as cupbearer unto the king, that he had not before been sad in his presence. Reflecting over the news of Jerusalem over the past 4 months, which had made Nehemiah very depressed in his demeanor, in thinking upon that. And so it was so noticeable that the king brought Nehemiah into question over it. He noticed that something had changed in Nehemiah's demeanor and so forth. Now, naturally, being the cupbearer, the king would not be thinking along the lines of his ancestry as far as Nehemiah's and the plight they were going through, but his would have been more, why is Nehemiah sad? Why is he countenance has changed? Is there something going on? Is there something that he might be aware of in his position that people are trying to do? Most generally, in being a king, they had to watch out for those that wished to assassinate them. And one of the easy ways would be also poison through his food or through his drink or whatever. And that was Nehemiah's responsibility as the cupbearer, to bear that cup unto the king and so forth. And so if something is weighing on your mind and you're thinking about it, the king's naturally going to become suspicious, because now there's been a change. Why is he like this? What's happening and going on? The observation of the king was that Nehemiah was not ill or sick producing this sadness. And the king concludes that it must be nothing but sorrow of heart, is what he says. It came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid. This very much alarmed Nehemiah, because the king could have had him executed for this breach of court etiquette concerning his unhappy presence in his service to the king. As cupbearer to the king, it would have been also during feast, during those that he was giving parties and banqueting to other dignitaries, so to speak, others from other countries, other governors, whoever, whatever. And so here you have someone that is very sad of countenance, disgruntled, more or less, and the king is in his festivities, and the king would not tolerate that. He would not put up with that. But we find answer to Nehemiah's prayer, where he said that he had asked God for mercy in his petition to be granted to him from the king. And we find that God did answer that portion of Nehemiah's prayer of wanting mercy granted to him, as the king extended to Nehemiah compassion. We find that, and the king said, and I said unto the king, let the king live forever. Why should my countenance be sad when the city of the place of my father's sepulchres lie waste and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? King had many responses he could come up with. He could say, well, that's not my concern. What about it? You've got a position in my court. You're well took care of. You have everything that you want. Why should that bother me? But we see here God's mercy in the answer to that prayer. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? What would you want, Nehemiah? What's your request? And that has to ultimately come from God through his providence, that he has allowed the king, Artaxerxes, to have that favor with Nehemiah. So Nehemiah tells the king why he is sad. The city of his father's Jerusalem is in destruction and the gates have been destroyed by fire. So I prayed to the God of heaven, Nehemiah says, latter part of chapter 4, after the king grants favor to Nehemiah and permits him to ask of what Nehemiah would request of him. He doesn't give a quick answer. He could have said, well, I want to go back, do this or that. But he prayed to God of heaven. He prayed to God and took it before him. Again, he goes to God in prayer. And we're not given what his prayer was directly, but we can rely on his first prayer that he asked God for the king to grant mercy to him and to honor his request. And so after his prayer to God, Nehemiah, the request was to let the king, number one, send him into Jerusalem to rebuild the city, and number two, to give letters from the king concerning the mission of Nehemiah to show unto the governors beyond to allow him to pass through, and three, to write a letter to Asaph, who was over the king's forest, to supply timber for the rebuilding of the walls and the gates. Verse 5, he said, And I said unto the king, If it please the king, and thy servant hath found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldst send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, For how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. He also, moreover, I said to the king, If it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come unto Judah. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace which pertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. The king asked, first of all, what's your time frame, Nehemiah? How long are you going to be gone? How long is this journey going to take? When are you going to come back? And Nehemiah sets a time that he has given. Again, we had looked back in Ezra chapter 7, verses 8 and 9, that number one, it took a 4-month journey for Ezra to go from Babylon to Jerusalem. So most likely it would take Nehemiah an 8-month journey to go to Jerusalem and to come back. So you've got 8 months there. Then you also have the time that's going to be needed to restore the city back, to rebuild the walls, rebuild the gates. So you have that time in there too. Nehemiah, the 5th chapter, in verse 14. Moreover, Nehemiah says, Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year, even unto the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, that is 12 years. He talks about him and his brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor. But when you look at chapter 13, in verse 6, And in all this time was I not at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king, and after certain days obtained I leave of the king. So again, you have here that it's recorded that he spent 12 years in Jerusalem in rebuilding of the city and of the walls, the 12 years that it took. So this had to be within the time frame that Nehemiah would gave the king, because he returned back in that 32nd year and honored the king's time frame to come back. So upon this, the king grants unto Nehemiah his request, and Nehemiah names God as a reason for the request being granted. His prayer was answered for mercy being granted to him from the king, which he had prayed for 4 months earlier. Remember, this prayer was 4 months earlier, and it was continuing on. So mercy is granted unto him from the king. When you think about what he had asked for, Nehemiah, of course, does have faith in God, but he is also asking that letters be given to him, because as he went through all the territories, this 4-month journey, he would have had a host with him. We find out that he has other things with him as far as timber and so forth that he's asking for. And it's going to be a large possession that he's going to have. There's going to be the king's army with him going. So he's got this going there. And each of these territories has governors that are self-ruling. And they can do whatever they want. But they're still, these governors are under the direction of Artaxerxes. So here is a letter that's presented to Nehemiah. He's asking for a letter from the king saying, grant me safe journey through each province, that the governors would have this letter, that they would allow me to pass unharmed. Whatever aid that they wished to give me, I could ask for and request and receive. And he was also asking for the supplies to be given unto him, that when you consider this journey that he had to make, the timber, number one, had to be cut, had to be somehow transported, loaded up and transported over this long journey, that when he got to Jerusalem, the material is already there. So he wanted the fine timber also that he wanted. Have the keeper of your forest, here's a letter saying, give me what I need to be able to rebuild the walls. So Nehemiah had all this planned ahead of time. The record does not tell of the journey other than Nehemiah had a host of the king's captains and horsemen provided by the king to aid in his journey, and that he had safe passage through the land by giving the letters of the king to the various governors of the land. And we see that after it was granted to them, then I came to the governors beyond the river, gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. So he had this host that was going with him as he made this journey. So he was well provided and well protected. In verse 10 of chapter 2, we are next introduced to Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah, his servant, or the servant, who was also an Ammonite. We are told in a historical record, in an Aramaic papyrus, that Sanballat was referred to as the governor of Samaria. If you remember, we'd already looked at the practice of the conquering nations was to displace the Jews, to take them out, and replace with foreign people in their land. The Samaritans were a mixture of these foreign people who had been placed in the land of Samaria. When you look at Ezra the fourth chapter in verse 10. And the rest of the nations whom the great and nobles in Sapphira brought over and said in the cities of Samaria and the rest that are on the side of the river at such a time. Here was a displacement of those that were brought over and set in to those cities. When you look at 2 Kings, again, you have the recording of what 2 Kings chapter 17 of what the conquering nations did. 2 Kings 17 and 24 reads there, and the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Kahath and from Ava and from Hamath and placed them in cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. So you have these foreign people that are in these cities and in this area, and naturally they're going to be really, I can't think of the word that I want. They're not going to be favorable to the children of Israel coming back. If you remember, the children of Israel had displaced these people when they came into the land, and the land was given to them as an inheritance from God. So this was theirs. They claimed it as theirs. Now with these foreign people coming in and these other nations, naturally with the Jewish people gone, land is up for grabs. This is our land. This is ours. This is, you know, it's not yours anymore. You were gone. But yet, the children of Israel always viewed it as, that is my right from God. That's my land, and that's it. It's mine forever. Because that's what God has promised, and it's mine. You still have the same situation going on today that over the land issue, that it was a perpetual promise. Well, we've looked at that before in other areas, that the perpetual doesn't mean forever, forever, forever. Number one. Number two, they transgressed and God removed them from that land promise. But this is the mixture that you've got. These other people that are there, they've been there for quite a while. It's their territory. They gained the political power with that, Sanballat being a governor, he's not going to give up. And naturally, he's going to think what's going to happen when these Jews come back. And he had it already with Zerubbabel, that he had to contend with him. You're not taking over. He had it with Ezra. Now he's got it with Nehemiah. Nehemiah comes back and ends up being a governor over Jerusalem and the area of Judah. And Sanballat's not going to like that because that used to be part of his. with Samaria and so forth. So he's referred to, Sambalat is referred to as a Horonite, which would have made him, make him from the land of Moab. The city in Moab would be Horonaim. When you look at Isaiah, the 15th chapter, the 15th chapter of Isaiah in verse 5, you have the correlation there between Moab and the city. Isaiah 15, verse 5, "My heart shall cry out for Moab, his fugitives shall flee into Zoar, a heifer of 3 years old, for by the mounting up of Luhath, with weeping shall they go up, go it up. For in the way of Horonaim they shall raise up a cry of destruction." So that's a city listed in Moab, which would have made him a Horonite. When you look at Jeremiah, the 48th chapter, Jeremiah, the 48th chapter, verse 3, "A voice of crying shall be from Horonaim, spoiling and great destruction." When you look at verse 5, verse 4 says, "Moab is destroyed, for in the going up of Luhath, continually weeping shall go up. For in the going down of Horonaim, the enemies have heard a cry of destruction." And then when you drop down to verse 34, "For the cry of Hezbon, even unto Eliah, and even from Jahaz, have they uttered their voice, from Zoar, even unto Horonaim, as a heifer 3 years old." Again, that city had destruction against it or pronounced, but Sambalat was from that area, being from Moab. Tobiah, his servant, was an Ammonite, being from the territory of Ammon. When you look at Moab and Ammon in the biblical map, of that territory, it would have been over toward the southeast a little bit. You had on the Sea of Galilee over there, you had Moab, you had Ammon, you had those cities over there. So they would have came over and been within the area of Judah and Jerusalem. They were located east of the Dead Sea, and again, these people would have been foreigners or aliens in the land of Moab, in the land of Samaria. So Sambalat would have heard concerning this great caravan. When you think about it, it would have had to come through his territory or around it. He would have heard about this great caravan coming through through his territory going to Jerusalem. You had the king's army along with Nehemiah and his group with supplies, the timber, which would have been very noticeable. And being that noticeable, Sambalat would have been trying to figure out what's going on. He's the governor. He's in charge of that. What's going on? What are they going to do? Sambalat and Tobiah were grieved exceedingly. It says when, in verse 10, chapter 2, "When Sambalat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel." He'd already been through this with Zerubbabel, with the work that was going on. They'd already been through this, and they'd already been successful in putting a deterrent or a slowdown or a stop to it. They had been successful in that, in writing letters to all the kings and so forth. "This group is bad. You know, you let them come back. Look what they're doing while you're over there in Babylon, and this is what they're doing over here, and they're going to, you know, you go back through and look at your records." The Jewish people have always been a rebellious people. They've always rebelled against the king. And so they're grieved exceedingly that Nehemiah has come to seek and help the welfare of the Jews from Jerusalem, and they were greatly vexed by this occurrence. When you think of what they would have been receiving, what would Sambalat, as governor of Samaria, what would he have been accountable for from the people, from the Jews that were there? He would have been accountable to them from getting, I would say, taxes. He could levy on them in Jerusalem, even though it wasn't rebuilt yet or whatever. The people round about, the Jews that had settled in there and other cities and so forth, he'd be receiving part of their crops. He'd be receiving tribute from them because he could exact that from them. And now here's a guy coming from the king with letters, and he's seeking their best interest. What's this going to do to Sambalat? it's going to alter and affect his little empire, so more or less, that he's got going on. It's going to affect him directly. It's going to affect him financially. It's going to affect him all the way around. So he's naturally going to fight against it. When Nehemiah comes, he arrived at Jerusalem, and we find recorded that for 3 days he did not do anything. Verse 11, so I came to Jerusalem, and there was there 3 days. He was 3 days. It is possible that after the long journey, Nehemiah took rest for the 3 days, just like Ezra did upon his arrival. When you look at Ezra, the 8th chapter, in verse 32, Ezra did the same thing. We came to Jerusalem and abode there 3 days. So Nehemiah took a rest also for 3 days. For what reason? We really can't say, but he didn't do anything for 3 days. And it may have been that he was just getting acquainted with the place and the situation. Before we get into from there on chapter 12 as far as what he did from there, we'll go ahead and stop there. Any question or comments? Okay, we'll start there next week then.